life indicators, like cost of living, educational attainments, crime rates, and so on, Australia bounced back up near the top. It ranks 7th on the United Nations Human Development Index, a little behind Canada, Sweden, the United States, and one or two others, but comfortably ahead of Germany, Switzerland, Austria, Italy, and several other countries with stout economies and higher GDPs. At the time of my visit, Australia was booming as never before. It was enjoying one of the fastest rates of economic growth in the developed world. Inflation was invisible. Unemployment was at its lowest level in years. Yet according to a study by the Australian Institute, 36% of Australians felt life was getting worse, and barely a fifth saw any hope of its getting better. These days, it is true, in terms of gross dollars accumulated per head, Australia is no longer near the top. It comes in at number 21, in fact. But I ask you, which would you rather be? Third richest and thrilled because you have an electric jug and at least one radio, or 21st richest and living in a world where you can have everything a person could reasonably want? On the other hand, in very few of these other countries do you run the slightest risk of being eaten by an estuarian crocodile, a thought that occurred to me now as I pulled out my second purchase, Crocodile Attack in Australia, by Hugh Edwards, and waded chest deep into its 240 pages of gruesome, violent attacks by this most cunning and unsporting of creatures. The saltwater crocodile is the one animal that has the capacity to frighten even Australians. People who would calmly flick a scorpion off their forearm, or chuckle fearlessly at a pack of skulking dingoes, will quake at the sight of a hungry croc, and I had not ventured far into the pages of Mr. Edwards's chilling chronicles before I began to understand why. Consider this tale of an afternoon at play in northwestern Australia. In March 1987, a yacht with five people aboard was making its way along the Kimberley coast when it detoured up the Prince Regent River to visit King's Cascade, a remote beauty spot where a tropical waterfall spills picturesquely over a granite outcrop. There they moored and went off variously to clamber over the cascades or have a swim. One of the swimmers was a young American model named Ginger Faye Meadows. As she and another young woman stood waist-deep on a rock ledge under the waterfall, one of them noticed the cold, steady eyes and half-submerged snout of a crocodile coming toward them. Now imagine it. You are standing with your back to a rock wall, much too steep and slippery to climb, with nowhere to retreat, and one of the deadliest creatures on earth is coming toward you. A creature so perfectly engineered to kill that it has scarcely changed in 200 million years. You are, in short, about to be killed by something from the age of the dinosaurs. One of the two women took off a plastic shoe and threw it at the crocodile. It bounced off his head, causing him to blink and hesitate. In the same instant, Meadows decided to make a break for it. She dove into the water and tried to swim the 25 yards to safety. The friend stayed put. Meadows swam with strong strokes, but the crocodile followed on a line designed to intercept her. About halfway across, it caught her around the middle and jerked her beneath the water. According to the boat's skipper, Meadows stayed under for several seconds, then surfaced with her hands in the air and a really startled look on her face. She was looking right at me, but she didn't say a word. Then she went under again and was seen no more. The next day would have been her 25th birthday. This is probably the most famous crocodile attack in Australia in the last 25 years, because it involved a well-known beauty spot, a luxury cruiser, and a victim from America who happened to be young and very good-looking. But here's the thing. There have been lots of others, perhaps as many as 150 in a century, according to Mr. Edwards. What's more, Meadows' death was atypical because she saw it coming. For most people, a crocodile attack comes completely unexpectedly. The chronicles of crocodile killings are full of stories of people standing in a few inches of water, or sitting on a bank, or strolling along an ocean beach, when suddenly the water splits, and before they can even cry out, much less enter into negotiations, they are carried away for leisurely devouring. That is what is so scary about them. Now I ask you, who gives a damn how much money people are making in Hong Kong or Singapore when you've got matters like that to worry about? That's all I'm saying. Chapter 9. I would happily have stayed another day or two in Adelaide, but I had tracks to make. It was almost time to meet my friends in Melbourne, but first I had a promise to myself of long standing to visit the Mornington Peninsula, a coastal area of beauty and charm just south of Melbourne. As ever in Australia, it would take some getting to. I left Adelaide early and was dismayed to discover, within an hour or two of setting off, that I was facing yet another long day of driving on empty roads through a featureless expanse. This seemed particularly unfair because, in the first place, I had supposed that I was heading back into civilization, and second, I'd had quite enough of this sort of thing already, and third, I had intentionally chosen a slightly longer route along a coastal highway to avoid the prospect of visual overland tedium. The road I was on was called the Princess Highway. The map showed it running in a graceful arc along the edge of a vast bay, identified as the Young Husband Peninsula. And indeed, it did present hours of sunny coastal views. But the tide was miles out, leaving the sea as a distant thread of bright blue on the far side of a million painfully reflective acres of salt pans. The inland side presented an equally featureless blankness, filled with a single, infinitely repeated species of low shrub. For 146 kilometers, the road was perfectly empty. To pass the time, I sang Australia's unofficial national anthem, Waltzing Matilda. It is an interesting song. It was written by Banjo Paterson, who was not only Australia's greatest poet of the 19th century, but also the only one named for a stringed instrument. It goes, and I think the record should show that these are the words precisely as set down by Paterson. Oh, there once was a swagman camped in the billabong, under the shade of a coolabah tree, and he sang as he looked at his old billy boiling, "Who'll come a-waltzing Matilda with me?" The main distinguishing feature of Waltzing Matilda, you will notice, is that it makes no sense. Obviously it makes no sense to anyone not familiar with bush lingo. That part was intentional. But even when you understand the words, it makes no sense. A billabong, for instance, is a water hole. So a question that immediately arises, before you have even concluded the first line, is, why was the swagman camped in it? I would camp beside it myself. You see what you are up against. The only possible conclusion is that Paterson had had a few when he grabbed his inkpot and dashed off the words. Anyway, just to keep you fully informed, a swagman, in Australian parlance, is an itinerant traveller. The term comes from the rolled blanket, or swag, he carried. Another name for a swag was a Matilda, from the German. Don't ask me, my interest in this goes only so far. A billy is a can for boiling water, and a coolabah tree is a coolabah tree. There you have the terms. Why the swagman is a-waltzing with his bedroll, and why above all he desires someone or something, in the second verse it's a sheep, for goodness sake, to join him in this bizarre and possibly depraved activity are, of course, questions that cannot be answered. On the other hand, it has a lovely tune. It's borrowed from an old Scottish air, Thou Bonnie Wood, O Craigie Lee, which I render particularly melodically, if I say so myself, especially with my head out the window to achieve that warbly effect that comes from singing into an onrush of air at speed. The problem with knowing only one verse, of course, is that it gets a trifle repetitive after a time. So you may conceive my satisfaction when I realized that if you changed Billy Boiling to Willy Boiling, and I should perhaps just note that a willy in Anglo-Australian argot is the part of a gentleman's anatomy that he would be least likely to place in a boiling medium, it put an entirely new slant on things, and I was able to come up with approximately 47 new stanzas, which not only extends the song to a length suitable for long bus journeys, but brings to it a dimension of coherence that it has lacked for almost a century. I might have gotten the verse total even higher, except that as I rounded the last sweep of bay and followed the road inland through a stretch of scrub, I came upon a sign announcing the Big Lobster, and in the excitement I abandoned my musical instruments. The Big Lobster, you see, was something, or more properly a species of something, that I had longed to see ever since I had hit the road. One of the more cherishable peculiarities of Australians is that they like to build big things in the shape of other things. Give them a bale of chicken wire, some fiberglass, and a couple of pots of paint, and they will make you, say, an enormous pineapple, or strawberry, or, as here, a lobster. Then they put a cafe and a gift shop inside, erect a big sign beside the highway, for the benefit of people whose acuity does not evidently extend to spotting a 50-foot-high piece of fruit standing beside an otherwise empty highway, then sit back and wait for the money to roll in. Some 60 of these objects are scattered across the Australian landscape, like leftover props from a 1950s horror movie. You can, if you have sufficient gas money and nothing approaching a real life, visit a big prawn, a big koala, a big oyster with searchlights for eyes, apparently, a big lawnmower, a big marlin, a big orange, and a big merino ram, among many others. The process, I am patriotically proud to tell you, was started by an American named Landy, who built a big banana at Coffs Harbour on the New South Wales coast, which proved so magically attractive to passing vehicles that it made Mr. Landy, as it were, the big banana of the business. Generally, these objects are cannily set along a stretch of highway so astoundingly void and dull that you will stop for almost anything. As, of course, I did now when the road bent once again, and I found looming before me a monstrously large, reddish-pink, commendably lifelike lobster, rearing up beside the road as if about to dine on a morsel of passing traffic. Owing to the peculiar shape of a lobster, the owners had decided, I imagine after quite a lot of thought, not to try to accommodate a gift shop and cafe inside. So the big lobster sat on the front lawn, secured with guy wires, while the retail facilities were in a separate building behind. I got out and approached for a closer look. It was impressively outsized. I learned from subsequent inquiry that it is 56 feet from the ground to the tip of its feelers, a good size even in the ambitious world of giant objects. I was looking at it from various angles when I realized that I had wandered into someone's photograph. "Oh, sorry," I called. "No worries, mate," he replied with an easygoing air. "You helped to give it scale." He came up and stood beside me. He was in his early 30s and looked vaguely sad and dorky, like someone who worked in a low-grade job and still lived at home. He was dressed as if for a vacation, in shorts and a T-shirt that said Noosa in large letters. Noosa is a Queensland resort. Together we stood and for quite a period silently admired the lobster. "Big, isn't it?" I remarked at last, for very little escapes me in the world of fiberglass crustaceans. "You wouldn't get a snap of me in front of it, would you?" he said in that curiously circular way in which Australians beg a favor. "Of course." He went and stood beside it, a hand perched affectionately on a foreleg. "You can tell people it's an engagement photo," I suggested. He liked that idea. "Yeah," he said keenly. "Meet the fiancée. She's not much for looks or conversation, but geez, can she scuttle." I decided I liked this guy. "So do you visit these things a lot?" I said, handing him back the camera. "Only if I'm passing, you know. It's a pretty good one, though. Better than the big koala at Moyston." I didn't feel there was a great deal I could say to this. "At Wachapi there's a big bull," he added. I raised my eyebrows in a way that said, "Oh, yes." He nodded fondly. "Its testicles swing in the breeze." "It has testicles," I said, impressed. "I'll say. If they fell on you, you wouldn't get up in a hurry." We took an extended moment to savor this image. "It would make an interesting insurance claim, I suppose," I observed at last. "Yeah, he liked this idea, too. Or a newspaper headline, 'Man crushed by falling bollocks.'" "By falling bullocks bollocks," I offered. "Yeah." We were getting on like a house on fire. I hadn't had a conversation this long in days. What am I saying? I hadn't had this much fun in days. Unfortunately, neither of us could think of anything more to say, and so we just stood awkwardly for a while. "Well, nice meeting you," he said at last, and with a shy smile shuffled off. "Nice meeting you," I said, and meant it. I went inside and bought a fridge magnet and about 15 big lobster postcards, and returned to the road in a mellow frame of mind. I headed the car toward Warrnambool and the famous Great Ocean Road, and drove some minutes in thoughtful silence. Then abruptly I thrust my head out the window, and in a sweet but robust voice sang, Forgetting that spoons stir hot liquids much better, the swagman immersed his tool in his tea, and he sighed as he spied his old willy boiling. Now I can't bugger you, so will you bugger me? I spent the night in Port Ferry, and drove on the next day to the Mornington Peninsula, along the Great Ocean Road, a tortuous, spectacularly scenic coastal highway built after World War I as a make-work scheme for veterans. It took 14 years to construct, and you can see why at once, because for most of its 187 miles, it swoops along an impossibly challenging coastline in a hair-raising manner, barreling around rocky headlands and clinging to the edges of sheer and crumbly cliffs. So demanding of attention are the endless hairpin bends that you scarcely have a moment to notice the views. But I figured an occasional glimpsed view was better than none. Here and there in the water stand pinnacles of rock created by the tireless erosive might of the sea. There used to be a natural rock arch called London Bridge, over which you could stroll to stand above the sea. But in 1990 it collapsed, sending tons of debris into the surf below, and stranding two startled but miraculously unharmed tourists on the seaward stub. London Bridge is now London Stacks. The drive was as gorgeous as the guidebooks had promised. On one side, the steep, wooded, semi-tropical hills of the Otway Ranges, plunging straight into the sea. On the other, foamy surf rolling onto long, curving beaches, framed at either end by rocky outcrops. This stretch of Victorian coast is famous for two things, surfing and shipwrecks. With its wild currents and famous fogs, the South Victorian coast was long notorious to mariners. If you took all the water away, you would see 1,200 ships lying broken on the seabed, more than almost anywhere else in the world. I stopped from time to time to get out and take in the views. It really was the only way for a solitary driver to see them, and poked about in one or two of the sweetly old-fashioned little resort communities that lay along the way. These were surprisingly quiet, considering that it was the height of the Australian summer and the day after a national holiday. It struck me, not for the first time, that there seemed to be more places in Australia for tourists to go than there were tourists to fill them. At a place called Torquay, the Great Ocean Road rejoined the main highway toward Melbourne. 20 miles to the west, I noticed, was Winchelsea, where Thomas Austin set free the 24 rabbits that transformed the Australian landscape. The countryside round about looked vaguely arid and unpromising. It reminded me of Oklahoma or western Kansas, but I had no way of knowing, of course, how much of this could be attributed to the voracity of rabbits. Now, you would think that people might have learned a lesson from Austin's experience, but amazingly, no. At the very moment that rabbits were eating their way across the countryside, influential people were introducing other species of animals in great numbers, sometimes for sport, sometimes by accident, but mostly in an effort to liven things up a little. Precisely the same impulse that led people to build English-style parks in places like Adelaide led them to try to manipulate the countryside as well. Australia was deemed biologically deficient, its semi-arid plains too monotonous, its forests too silent. Gradually there arose acclimatization societies that made scores of eager introductions to fulfill a longing for the familiar. Before long, it occurred to the societies that there was no reason to stop with British or even European animals. They began to dream of creating an African veldt in Australia, with giraffes, springboks, and buffaloes grazing the sunny plains. Their aspirations took on an almost surreal quality. In 1862, Sir Henry Barclay, Governor of Victoria, called for the introduction of monkeys into the colony's forests for the amusement of wayfarers, whom their gambols would delight. Before this could be acted on, Barclay had been replaced as governor by Sir Charles Darling, who said he didn't want monkeys, but would be very pleased to see boa constrictors. He didn't get his way either, but scores of others did. Acclimatization was one of the most foolish and dangerous ideas ever to infect the thinking of 19th-century men, writes Tim Lowe in the improbably gripping Feral Future, the untold story of Australia's exotic invaders. But infect them it did. Victoria, for some reason, became the hotbed of all this. Despite the experience with rabbits, dozens of other foolish introductions were made. In the 1860s, the Ballarat Acclimatization Society loosed foxes into the landscape, and they quickly became a scourge, a position from which they have not yet retreated. Other animals escaped or were abandoned and went wild. Camels were used to build the railroad from Adelaide to Alice Springs, but were set free when the work was completed. Today, 100,000 of them roam the central and western deserts, the only place in the world where one-humped dromedaries exist in the wild. Across the country, there are up to 5 million wild donkeys, 1 million or more wild horses, called brumbies, and large numbers of water buffaloes, cows, goats, sheep, pigs, foxes, and dogs. Feral pigs have been caught in Melbourne suburbs. There are so many introduced species, in fact, that the once mighty red kangaroo is now only the 13th largest animal in the country. The consequences for native species have often been devastating. About 130 mammals in Australia are threatened. 16 have gone extinct, more than in any other continent. And guess what is the mightiest killer of all? According to the National Parks and Wildlife Service, it is the common cat. Cats love the Australian wild. There are 12 million of them out there, inhabiting every niche in the landscape, from the driest deserts to the tallest mountains. With the fox, they have driven many of Australia's smallest, cutest, and most vulnerable native animals to the edge of extinction. Numbats, bettongs, quolls, potoroos, bandicoots, rock wallabies, platypuses, and many others. Since most of these creatures are nocturnal and rarely seen, most people don't notice their absence, but they are going fast. As with animals, so with plants. In the 1860s, Victoria was unfortunate to have as chief botanist a dedicated acclimatizer with the imposing name of Baron Ferdinand Jacob Heinrich von Müller. As with animal acclimatizers, von Müller couldn't abide what he viewed as the impoverished nature of Australia's flora, and he spent much of his free time traveling the country sowing seeds of pumpkins, cabbages, melons, and whatever else he thought might flourish. He had a special affection for blackberries, planting clumps of them all over. The blackberry is now Victoria's most pernicious weed, all but ineradicable, and the bane of farmers everywhere. Where unmolested, it takes over whole landscapes. I saw some now as I drove along. The lesson in this, that exotic species often thrive in Australia in a way that staggers belief, is one that Australians have had a curiously hard time fully grasping. Prickly pear, a type of pulpy cactus native to America, was introduced in Queensland early in the 20th century as a potential stock feed and quickly went crazy. By 1925, 30 million acres were overrun with impenetrable groves of prickly pear up to 6 feet high. It is an almost absurdly dense plant. An acre of prickly pear weighs 800 tons, as against about 15 tons for an acre of wheat, and a nightmare to clear. For a while, it looked as if much of Queensland and beyond would simply become one Europe-sized bed of prickly pear. Fortunately, it could be treated effectively with pesticides and a moth whose larvae relished its leaves, but it was a close-run thing, and the cost was substantial. Altogether, according to Lowe, Australia is now home to more than 2,700 foreign weeds. Interestingly, botanical gardens are among the worst offenders. Three escapees from Darwin's botanic gardens, Mimosa Bush, Lucina, and Crutch Tree, threaten Kakadu National Park, a World Heritage Site, and there have been others elsewhere. Where these things come from is often a mystery. According to Lowe, in recent years a biting ant, from the genus Eridomyrmex, has infested Brisbane. It has become a common nuisance. Interestingly, no one knows where it came from or how it got there. It just one day appeared. Nor, for obvious reasons, can anyone say where it will spread, or what quiet havoc it might wreak. One thing alone is certain. As so often, it appears to be doing better in Australia than wherever it came from. The Mornington Peninsula is a spur of land just south of Melbourne. It is, I suppose, Victoria's Cape Cod, in that it is coastal and very pretty, and crowded with summer homes. It even has something of the same shape, curling around in a scorpion tail that almost encloses the considerable immensity of Port Phillip Bay, across which, at a distance of some 50 miles, stands Melbourne. I had two particular reasons for wanting to be here. Catherine Veitch had made it sound so appealing in her letters. And it was here that Australia's tragically submersible Prime Minister, Harold Holt, went for his final swim. Holt's fateful dip was at Portsea, at the peninsula's far end, so it was there I directed myself the next morning after overnighting in the little town of Mornington. Though I set off in watery sunshine, of the sort that seemed to promise a fine day later on, Portsea was settled under a heavy sea mist, and the temperature when I stepped out of the car was cooler than it had been 20 miles up the road. Most of the few people out in Portsea, I noticed, were wearing cotton sweaters or jackets. Portsea is very small, a handful of shops and cafes against a larger backdrop of big houses, looking aloof and broody in the wispy fog, but famously well-heeled. A beach hut had just sold at auction here for $185,000. Not a beach house, you understand, but a beach hut, a simple wooden shed with no electricity, water, or any features at all other than proximity to sand and water. The purchaser didn't even actually get to own the hut. All his $185,000 bought him was the right, in perpetuity, to pay the council several hundred dollars in annual rent. The huts, which only locals are allowed to acquire, are immensely prized possessions. The one that had just been sold had been in the same family for 50 years. I had coffee to warm up before continuing on to the Mornington Peninsula National Park, which covers the last nubbin of land before it meets the sea at a hilly outpost called Point Nepean, beyond which lies a notorious swirl of water called the Rip, a narrow passage forming the entrance to Port Phillip Bay. Only recently had this land become public. For 100 years, the whole of this area, several hundred acres of the most glorious coastal property in Victoria, was off limits to the public because it was owned by the military, which used it as a firing range. Pause with me for a moment while we put this in perspective. Here you have a country of 3 million square miles, nearly all of it empty and eminently bombable. And here, just a couple of hours' drive outside the country's second city, you have a headland of rare and sumptuous beauty and of considerable ecological importance. And from this land you bar the public because you're trying to blow it to smithereens. Doesn't make much sense, what? The upshot is that after many years of wheedling and cajoling, the military was finally prevailed upon to yield a fragment of this land to form a national park. Even so, the army kept about 2/3 of the peninsula and still occasionally lofts bombs into it. In consequence, once you have acquired a ticket of admission at a visitor center on the edge of Portsea, you have to pass through a 2-mile-long zone of military land on a road lined on both sides with tall fences bearing severe warnings of unexploded bombs and the folly of trespass. You can take a shuttle bus into the park or walk. I decided to walk for the exercise and set off through the cloaking mist. I appeared to have the place pretty much to myself. I had gone no more than 12 feet when I was joined by a fly, smaller and blacker than a housefly. It buzzed around in front of my face and tried to settle on my upper lip. I swatted it away, but it returned at once, always to the same spot. A moment later it was joined by another that wished to go up my nose. It also would not go away. Within a minute or so I had perhaps 20 of these active spots all around my head, and I was swiftly sinking into that state of abject wretchedness that comes with a prolonged encounter with the Australian fly. Flies are, of course, always irksome, but the Australian variety distinguishes itself with its very particular persistence. If an Australian fly wants to be up your nose or in your ear, there is no discouraging him. Flick at him as you will, and each time he will jump out of range and come straight back. It is simply not possible to deter him. Somewhere, on an exposed portion of your body, is a spot, about the size of a shirt button, that the fly wants to lick and tickle and turn delirious circles upon. It isn't simply their persistence, but the things they go for. An Australian fly will try to suck the moisture off your eyeball. He will, if not constantly turned back, go into parts of your ears that a Q-tip can only dream about. He will happily die for the glory of taking a tiny dump on your tongue. Get 30 or 40 of them dancing around you in the same way, and madness will shortly follow. And so I proceeded into the park, lost inside my own little buzzing cloud of woe, waving at my head in an increasingly hopeless and desultory manner. It is called the bush salute, blowing constantly out of my mouth and nose, shaking my head in a kind of furious dementia, occasionally slapping myself with startling violence on the cheek or forehead. Eventually, as the flies knew all along, I gave up, and they fell upon me as on a corpse. At length the flies and I reached the end of the military zone and the beginning of the park proper. Just inside this transition area was a signposted path leading up a medium-sized eminence called Cheviot Hill. This is what I had come to see, for it was at Cheviot Beach, on the other side, that Harold Holt went for the swim that needs no towel. I followed the path upward through misty groves of low bushy trees, muna, milkwort, and tea trees, according to helpful notice boards posted at intervals. At the top of the hill, a stiff breeze was running, forceful enough to make me totter when I neglected to brace for it, and here at last the flies gave me a tiny bit of surcease. I stood with the wind full in my face, happier than I can tell you just to be left alone. The view from the top of Cheviot Hill is said to be one of the finest in coastal Victoria, though I cannot vouch for this as I could see almost nothing. Across a grey-green vale, a mile or so distant, rose another hill at Point Nepean, covered in lazy cloud. Beyond was the notorious Rip, invisible from here. Below me, things were no less impenetrable. I appeared to be perhaps 100 feet directly above Cheviot Beach, but it was like peering into a cauldron. All I could see through the drifting soup were some vague outlines of rocks and an indeterminate expanse of sand. Only the sounds of unseen waves flopping onto an unseen shore made it evident that I had found the sea. Still, I felt a frisson of satisfaction at having reached the scene of Holt's fateful swim. I tried to imagine the scene as it must have been, though it wasn't easy. On the day Holt waded into the surf, the weather was windy but fine. Things were not going very well for him as Prime Minister. His skills lay more in kissing babies and making the ladies tingle. He was evidently a bit of a hottie, than in running affairs of state. And we may safely assume that he was glad to be out of Canberra for the long Christmas break. Holt came to this beach because he had a weekend home at Portsea, and the army let him stroll on its grounds for the sake of his privacy. So there were no lifeguards, members of the public, or even security guards in attendance when, on December 17, 1967, Holt went for a breezy stroll with some friends among the rocks and pounding waves just below. Although the sea was lively and the tide dangerously high, and although Holt had almost drowned there 6 months earlier while snorkeling with some chums, he decided to go for a swim. Before anyone could react, he had whipped off his shirt and plunged into the surf. He swam straight out from the beach a couple of 100 feet, and almost instantly vanished, without fuss or commotion, or even a languorous wave. He was 59 years old, and had been Prime Minister for not quite 2 years. His body was never found. Cheviot Beach remains closed to the public, so I amused myself for a few minutes prowling through a complex of pillboxes and murky concrete bunkers left over from World War II, until I walked into a large cobweb, and with an echoing shriek and a few moments of caroming about between walls, low lintels, and other unyielding impedimenta, returned in subdued form to the open air. Rubbing my head and calling round the flies again, I followed the path back down to the road. At the bottom of the hill was a large and straggly cemetery, a relic from when this was a quarantine station. I tried to have a look around, but the flies would give me no peace. I had intended to stroll out to the headland, where there was a 19th-century fort, but the thought of having the flies as my companions for another hour was more than I could endure. So I set off back along the empty road by which I had come. At the visitor center, I stopped in to have a look at the displays and got to chatting with the park ranger. I asked him how dangerous this stretch of coastline was. "Oh, very," he said cheerfully. He showed me on a marine chart how the currents ran, which is to say, all over the place. If they got hold of you, I gathered, they would pass you around like an unwanted parcel. Even the strongest swimmer would soon be exhausted by the fight. It was mostly to do with the rip, where massive volumes of water rush through an opening only a few hundred yards across each time the tide rolls in or out. I hadn't realized until I saw the chart just how proximate Cheviot Beach was to this zone of watery turmoil. Even on a map, it looked supremely foolhardy. So it wasn't a good idea for Harold Holt to go swimming out there. "Well, I wouldn't go swimming out there," he replied. "You know, there's about 100 shipwrecks just along here." He indicated an absurdly modest stretch of shoreline in the vicinity of Cheviot and the Rip. "I think you can take it as read that when you've got a stretch of sea that sinks 100 ships, it's probably not the most placid environment for a dip, you know? Isn't it odd that they never found his body?" "No." This was said without hesitation. "Really? I don't understand the dynamics of the sea, but if driftwood and coke cans are anything to go by, then I thought most buoyant objects ended up on a beach somewhere. Not to be too blunt about it, if you die out there, it doesn't take too long to become part of the food chain." "Ah. The thing you've got to remember," he added with a sudden thoughtful air, "is that the only thing unusual about the Harold Holt drowning was that he was Prime Minister when it happened. If it hadn't been for that, the whole thing would have been completely forgotten. Mind you, it's pretty well forgotten anyway. So you don't get a lot of people coming here in a kind of pilgrimage?" "No, not at all. Most people barely remember it. A lot of people under 30 have never even heard of it." He broke off to issue tickets to some new arrivals, and I drifted away to look at the displays of seagrasses and life in rock pools. But as I was leaving, he called to me with an afterthought. "They built a memorial to him in Melbourne," he said. "Know what it was?" I indicated that I had no idea. He grinned very slightly. "A municipal swimming pool." "Seriously?" His grin broadened, but the nod was sincere. "This is a terrific country," I said. "Yeah," he agreed happily. "It is, you know." Chapter 10. Throughout my childhood, on Friday nights, whenever my father was away, which was often, he was a sports writer who traveled a lot for his work, my mother and I had an arrangement whereby I would take a bus downtown to meet her. She also worked for the local paper. And we would go to dinner at a cafeteria called Bishop's, and then to a movie. I don't wish to suggest that my mother abused the trust I placed in her with regard to the selection process, but it did seem uncanny that the movies I favored had always just left town, and that we ended up seeing something involving murder, passion, and betrayal, usually starring Jeff Chandler, for whom my mother had a strange admiration, usually in a part that required him to spend a good deal of time bare-chested. "Oh," she would tut in a tone of shared chagrin, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea is just gone, but the Orpheum has the new Jeff Chandler movie, Tame Lust. Shall we go see that?" I don't know if, through the passage of time, these movies have blurred into one in my memory, or whether they actually were all identical, but they seemed always to have the same elements. Way too much talking, lots of steamy embraces with Lana Turner or some other hard-looking blonde. Very occasional gunfire resulting in a clutched belly, a staggered walk, and a disappointingly modest seepage of blood. And a part for Chandler that put him frequently on a speedboat or lifeguard stand, dressed only in swimming trunks. Without even looking at the screen, you could tell which were the swimming trunk scenes because of the avidity with which my mother would begin to suck her lemon drops. If a Jeff Chandler movie wasn't available, and amazingly sometimes whole weeks passed in which he didn't produce a picture, we would have to see something else. Thus it was that one week when I was about 9 we went to see The Sundowners, a Technicolor epic starring Robert Mitchum and Deborah Carr, in the story of a lovably feisty and indomitable couple making a life for themselves in the Australian bush. It was a memorable movie in many ways, not least in that it provided the endearing spectacle of Robert Mitchum doing an Aussie accent, and that it dealt with Australia at all, which made it, in Hollywood terms, essentially unique. Nearly 40 years after the event, I don't recall much of the detail of the film, other than that Mitchum and Carr spent every waking moment herding armies of sheep and fighting one discommoding peril of Antipodean life after another. Bushfires, dust storms, drought, locust infestations, and pub brawls, mostly. It was also evidently very hot in Australia. Mitchum never spoke without first taking off a dusty hat and running a forearm across his brow. Since my plans for myself, even at the age of 9, were to spend my adulthood driving an open-top sports car through Europe with Gene Seberg at my side, I concluded that Australia was of essentially zero interest and did not actively think about it again for 30 years. In consequence, when I finally made my first trip down under to attend the 1992 Melbourne Writers' Festival, I was actually able to be astounded to find it there at all. I clearly recall standing on Collins Street in downtown Melbourne, so freshly arrived that I still smelled of, possibly even glistened from, the insecticide with which the flight attendants sprayed the plane before arrival, watching the clanging trams and swirl of humanity, and thinking, "Good Lord, there's a country here." It was as if I had privately discovered life on another planet, or a parallel universe where life was at once recognizably similar, but entirely different. I can't tell you how exciting it was. Insofar as I had accumulated any expectations of Australia at all in the intervening years, I had thought of it as a kind of alternative Southern California, a place of constant sunshine and the cheerful vapidity of a beach lifestyle, but with a slight British bent, a sort of Baywatch with cricket, as I thought it. But this was nothing like that. Melbourne had a settled and gracious air that was much more European than North American, and it rained the whole week, which delighted me inordinately because it was so totally not what I had expected. What's more, and here we come to the real crux of things, I liked it, straight off, without quibble or doubt, in a way I had never expected to. Something about it just agreed with me. I suppose it helped that I had spent half my life in America and half in Britain, because Australia was such a comfortable fusion of the two. It had a casualness and vivacity, a lack of reserve, a comfortableness with strangers that felt distinctly American, but hung on a British framework. In their optimism and informality, Australians could pass at a glance for Americans, but they drove on the left, drank tea, played cricket, adorned their public places with statues of Queen Victoria, dressed their children in the sort of school uniforms that only Britannic people could wear without conspicuous regret. I felt extremely comfortable with this. Almost at once I became acutely, and in an odd way delightedly, aware of how little I knew about the place. I didn't know the names of their newspapers or universities or beaches or suburbs, knew nothing of their history or private achievements, couldn't tell a policeman from a postman. I didn't even know how to order coffee. It appeared that you had to specify a length, principally long or short, a color, black or white, and even an angle of orientation to the perpendicular, flat or not. And these could be put together in a multitude of permutations. Long black, short black, even long short black. My own preference, I discovered after many happy hours of experimentation, was flat white. It was a moment of the sublimest happiness. Because my responsibilities at the festival were extremely slight, one or two stage presentations and a little light sweeping afterward, I was free to roam through the city, and I did so with the greatest enthusiasm and devotion, eavesdropping on conversations, sitting in coffee bars with all the morning newspapers and half a dozen beverages. I was still in the experimental stage, devouring both, reading labels and billboards and the signs in shop windows, asking questions of complete strangers. "Excuse me, what's a Jackie Howe? What are Norks? What's an Ocker?" Respectively, a type of sleeveless T-shirt, a slang term for breasts. I saw it on the cover of a magazine and actually made a cashier blush in asking, but how else to learn? And a boorish person. I loved, still do, Australian voices, the lilt and cadence, the effortlessly dry, direct way of viewing the world. At a reception for some minor awards presentation, the East Gippsland Young Farmer's First Novel Award, or something, which I attended because I was just so pleased to get an invitation to anything, and because cocktails were promised, I was standing with two female publicists from my publishers when some obviously self-infatuated bigwig breezed in. "Oh, look, it's Bruce Dazzling," observed one, and then, with a kind of distant, perfectly encapsulating disdain, added, "He'd go to the opening of an envelope." Someone else told me the story of an English friend of his who was flying to Australia when the stewardess tonged him a hot towel. which proved upon application to be cold. So he told her, not in complaint, but simply because he thought she might want to warm them up some more. The stewardess turned to him and, smiling sweetly, with only the tiniest trace of sarcasm, said, "Well, why don't you sit on it a bit? That should warm it up." I knew as soon as I heard that story that I was going to like this place. I haven't stopped yet. Because my first exposure was to Melbourne, I formed a certain slavish attachment to the place. I still find it terribly exciting to arrive in Melbourne. Not an emotion you will hear expressed often, but there you are. And driving now through the glossy high-rises of its central business district had something of the feel of a homecoming. Over there was the first Australian hotel I'd stayed in. There the first coffee shop I'd tried. There the celebrated Melbourne cricket ground, where I once spent 3 hours happily bewildered by an Australian rules football match, and dined on my first and last 4-and-20 pie, made with real blackbirds, I was drolly assured. Insofar as such a statement could have meaning, this was my home in Australia. Most people, and when I say most people, I mean, of course, me when I first got there, don't realize that for a long time Melbourne was much the most important city in Australia. Although Sydney has been slightly the bigger of the two for most of this century, Melbourne's population now is about 3.5 million to Sydney's 4 million, Melbourne was until relatively recently the center of things, particularly in the realms of finance and culture. Sydney used to compensate by making up cruel but generally outstanding jokes about Melbourne's supposed lack of liveliness, like, "Do you have any children?" "Yes, two living and one in Melbourne." These days, Sydney makes jokes about Melbourne and steals its thunder, which is naturally a little hard for Melbourne people to take. Nothing better illustrates the shift in the two cities' relative standings than that in 1956 the Olympics went to Melbourne, and in 2000 they've gone to Sydney. Most things do nowadays. In 1956, Melbourne was headquarters to 50 of Australia's largest companies, while Sydney had just 37. Today, the proportions are almost exactly reversed. A generation ago, international companies routinely chose Melbourne for their Australian headquarters. Today, over two-thirds opt for Sydney. But far more galling to a city that has always viewed Sydney as having the intellectual vibrancy of, let us say, daytime television, Melbourne has had to watch as Sydney has appropriated chunks of its cultural preeminence. In publishing, fashion, film and television, all the performing arts. I used to visit my Australian publishers in Melbourne. Today I go to Sydney. Having said all that, and once you strip out the huge visual advantage Sydney derives from its harbour, there's precious little to choose between the two in terms of quality of life or cultural satisfaction. Much less separates Melbourne from Sydney than separates Los Angeles from New York or Birmingham from London. Melbourne may not have a harbour bridge or an opera house like Sydney's, but it has something in its way no less singular. It has the world's most bizarre right turns. If you are driving in central Melbourne and you wish to go right, and bear in mind that you are driving on the left, you don't get in the middle lane, but rather pull over to the left-hand curb, as far away as possible from where you want to be, and sit there for an indeterminate period. In my case, until all the clubs and restaurants have shut and everyone has gone home for the night, and make your turn from there. It's all to do with keeping out of the way of the trams, Melbourne's other specialty, which go down the middle of the roads and can't have turning cars blocking their way. It's immensely confusing, not only to visitors from overseas, but to other Australians, even, I suspect, to many Melbourne people. But what really sets Melbourne apart is its love of Australian rules football, a sport little followed in Sydney or New South Wales, where rugby is the passion. It's interesting that Melburnians don't tell jokes about Sydney. They tell jokes about their beloved footy, to wit. A man arriving for the grand final in Melbourne is surprised to find the seat beside his empty. Tickets for the grand final are sold out weeks in advance, and empty seats unknown. So he says to the man on the other side of the seat, "Excuse me, do you know why there's no one in this seat?" "Oh, it's my wife's," answers the second man, "but I'm afraid she died." "That's terrible, I'm so sorry." "Yes, she never missed a match." "But couldn't you have given the ticket to a friend or relative?" Oh, no, they're all at the funeral. I was on my way to meet an old friend named Alan Howe, who, it so happens, is the person who introduced me to the transfixing peculiarities of Australian rules. I first met him nearly 20 years ago when I was working as a copy editor on the business desk of the Times in London, and he was a downy-faced recruit from down under. I had been there for a few months already, when he arrived and was given a seat beside me on the copy desk. I don't want to say he was awfully young back then, but he was wearing a Cub Scout uniform. I took him under my wing as a fellow colonial, and taught him all I knew. Admittedly, this was only three things. That Lloyd's of London had an apostrophe, while Lloyd's Bank did not. That the hyphen was oddly placed in the company name Rio Tinto Zinc. And that the staff cafeteria was in the basement. But in those days, that was all you needed to know to work on the business desk. He was a quick learner, and he soon outstripped us all. I remember one day I was having an argument with a colleague over whether the P.E. in P.E. ratio stood for Penis Envy or Prince Edward, and Howe told us that it was short for Price Earnings, and I knew then that this was a guy who was going places. He hasn't disappointed us, I must say. After a distinguished spell at the Times, he returned to Australia, where he became a rising star in the Murdoch firmament, fetching up in the early 1990s as editor of the Sunday Herald Sun, over which popular publication he still presides. When I think of him sitting there at the Times in his little neckerchief and blue shirt, my old heart swells with pride. He and his wife, a kindly and placid soul named Carmel Egan, live in South Melbourne in a lovely old house that was formerly a butcher's shop, of all things. I was late in arriving, owing to a little inadvertent experiment I conducted to establish whether it is possible to find your way to an address in Melbourne using a street plan for Perth. But I found it at length. It was Carmel who received me. "Howie's out," she said, ushering me in. "He's gone for a run." A run? I tried not to sound too astounded, but in the years I had known him, Howe's idea of a whole-body workout was to drink standing up. Besides, he was one of those restless, high-energy people who are constitutionally incapable of putting on fat. He needed to run the way I needed to increase my children's college expenses. "It's his heart," she added. I stared at her. "He's got a heart problem." "No, of course not," she laughed. "He's just, you know, discovered it." I understood at once. Howe has long been one of the world's great hypochondriacs. For years he has been moving from organ to organ, certain that one of them is about to maim him in a painful and costly way. He is forever standing off in corners, palpating himself for mysterious lumps, and adjusting his lifestyle accordingly. So Carmel and I sat and had a nice cup of tea, and I told her fond stories about her husband in those far-off London days before she had met him. How I taught him to use soap and wear matching socks, and helped him to find the treatments that made his gonads drop. The usual sort of thing. It was at this point that the great man himself flopped into the house, extravagantly flushed, breathless, and sweaty. "Hey, mate," he managed to breathe out in what looked like might be his dying words. "Are you okay?" "Never been better." "What are you running for?" I said. "Ticker, mate." "There's nothing wrong with your heart." "That's right," he said proudly. "And do you know why? Because I look after it." He nodded sagely, as if I hadn't thought of that, and cast a privately thoughtful glance at my bulk. In the evening, we walked to a local restaurant, where we talked agreeably about a million things. Mutual friends, work, where I had been on this trip and where I was going. All the sorts of things you talk about when you get together with friends you see but rarely. At one point, Howe mentioned casually that he had recently been boogie boarding at Byron Bay in New South Wales when he had encountered a shark. "Truly," I said, impressed. He nodded. "It was a fair size, too. 9 or 10 footer, I'd say." "So how close was it?" "Close. I could just about have touched it." "So what did you do?" "Strategically retreated. What do you think?" "Weren't you scared?" He made a look of sudden enthusiasm, as if I had just put my finger on something. "Yeah," he said, "I was a bit." "A bit?" "Oh, yeah," he returned wholeheartedly, as if being a bit scared was the maximum permitted in Australia, which I suppose it is. This led to a fond recollection of other near-death experiences with animals, of which Australians always have a large fund. an encounter with a crocodile in Queensland, killer snakes nearly stepped on, waking up to find a redback rappelling on a thread toward one's face. Australians are very unfair in this way. They spend half of any conversation insisting that the country's dangers are vastly overrated and that there's nothing to worry about, and the other half telling you how 6 months ago their Uncle Bob was driving to Mudgee when a tiger snake slid out from under the dashboard and bit him on the groin, but that it's okay now because he's off the life support machine and they've discovered he can communicate with eye blinks. I was, of course, all ears for all of this. "So what's the story with the crocodile?" I asked eagerly. Howe smiled with just a hint of sheepishness. "Well, Carmel and I were on holiday up in Queensland, at a place called Port Douglas, when we decided..." He saw her about to correct him. "When I decided that it would be fun to hire a boat and go out for a little fishing." "In a crocodile-infested estuary," Carmel added. She turned to me. "Alan was too cheap to pay for a big boat with a guide, so we got a little boat by ourselves. A very little boat." She allowed him to continue. "So we got this little boat," he went on, with a magnanimous nod in her direction, "with a little outboard motor on it, and we set off across this kind of estuary. The estuary was annoyingly crowded with other boats, but I spotted an inlet, and I thought, oh, we'll try up there. The inlet turns out to be a river, a really beautiful one. So we go cruising up this river, and it's just wonderful, your quintessential tropical paradise. Big green river, jungle backdrop, colorful birds flying through the trees. You can imagine it. Best of all, there's not a soul around. We've got it all to ourselves. So we find a nice spot, and I cut the engine, and we're sitting there with our fishing lines in the water, having a nice, relaxing time, when Carmel points out a kind of muddy bear patch on the bank, and we realize it's a crocodile launching place. Couldn't be anything else. Then we notice that there are several of these launching places all along the bank. It starts to dawn on us that maybe this is why there's nobody else up here, because it's infested with crocodiles. Just as we are coming to this significant conclusion, there's a splash off to one side, like something heavy going into the water, and then a line in the water moving vaguely toward us. Whoa, I said. My sentiments exactly, Bryson. He grinned. So what did you do? Well, like the good sailor I am, I hopped to the motor to get us out of there. Only the motor wouldn't start. It just would not go. Meanwhile, Carmel interjected, I'm sitting in the back of the boat watching this line coming towards us and saying, Alan, the crocodile's coming. It's definitely coming our way. Let's get out of here, mate. What do you say? And I'm pulling on the cord and pulling and pulling, and the engine is just going pup-pup-pup-poof. And all the while the crocodile's coming. Finally, miraculously, the engine catches and we're able to move off. Only we're pointing the wrong direction, so we've got to go up the river, away from where we want to be, in order to turn around. Anyway, after much messing around and crashing into banks and a little affectionate discussion of how we're going to die in a minute and it's all my fault, we get turned around. Only to get out of there, we've got to go towards where the crocodile is. So where's the crocodile now? No idea. There's no sign of him now. He's there somewhere, but we don't know where. He could be right alongside the boat, for all we know. The water's so murky you can't see 2 inches into it. But we do know that sometimes crocodiles go for boats. Especially little cheap tinny boats, Carmel said, smiling at him. Alan grinned happily. So I throw open the throttle, he went on, and the boat putters along at about 1/2 mile an hour, because it is, I have to admit, a very small and cheap boat. We've got to go maybe 1/4 mile through the crocodile's territory at crawling speed, and all the while we're sitting there expecting to feel a bang against the hull and to be tipped into the water. It was a little unnerving. Did you know, I said, that an outboard motor engine, when heard underwater, sounds very like the territorial growl of a male crocodile? That's why crocodiles so often go for small boats, apparently. They looked at me with amazement. It's not often a foreigner gets to scare the crap out of Australian listeners, but I had just read the book, after all. I'm so glad I didn't know that at Port Douglas, Carmel said. She gave an expansive shiver. But you got back okay, I take it, I asked. Alan beamed. We went down the river, across the estuary, and were out of that boat, and I mean clean out, before it touched the dock. He looked at me with a very pleased and expectant smile. "And how long do you think we'd had the boat out? We'd hired it for half a day, bear in mind." I indicated that I couldn't guess. Hal leaned toward me, beaming all over. 29 minutes, he said with the supreme